The next case, which today is 02-1199, Stephen Hay versus the Indiana State Board Tax Commission. Good morning, Mr. Pippin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am David Pippin on behalf of the appellants, collectively the taxpayers. The case that we have before us today is an appeal of a district court dismissal for lack of jurisdiction without an evidentiary hearing, without oral argument, and without an opportunity for discovery to be completed. The taxpayers believe that it is an error for the tax court to dismiss a case for lack of jurisdiction without first the jurisdictional allegations in the complaint being put into question, and certainly second, without the taxpayers being given opportunity to develop the record to show that there is a basis in fact for the allegation of complaint. Before I get into the argument, I would like to bring the court a little bit of information about what has happened in the state of Indiana in the past with its tax assessment system and what it's doing to reform that and how that affects the issues that are before the court. Before
you do that, if you don't mind, because you cited Commodity Trend and Bastion for the proposition that a court may look beyond the four corners in the complaint when a defendant proffers evidence that calls the court's jurisdiction into question. And what I want to ask you is if you are arguing that a court would be precluded from questioning jurisdiction on its own merely because the defendant hasn't proffered evidence challenging jurisdiction.
No, there are several circumstances, but the first prerequisite to that kind of question is that there is some question brought upon the factual pleading. In Bastion, the court said that they didn't have to look beyond the complaint to see the effect of the case, to see that it fell into a preemption circumstance. So the court didn't have to go beyond the four corners to look at the effect of it to see that it was precluded. So certainly in that circumstance, it's a situation. And in commodity trading, the court said that you can look at all of the evidence that's been submitted, all of the evidence before the court, to take a review. So certainly a court is not bound to blindly take information, but there has to be some question of the factual presentation, and then there has to be a review of that. And the taxpayer believes beyond the first prerequisite, which is some question of the facts, there's a second aspect of that that this court has consistently applied, and that is the right of the taxpayer to confront that evidence or to develop the record further. Saperstein, I believe, was a case that this court handed down that was very on point with that, where there actually was a proffer of a sworn affidavit, and the court said, you can't just accept that affidavit to dismiss this case. You have to look further. Give the plaintiff an opportunity to go back and develop the record and determine the credibility of that which has been presented before.
Exactly what evidence are you claiming was outside of the complaint that the district court relied on?
The district court did a couple things. One, it went to case law that it didn't. No record was submitted for the case law that the court reviewed, and the court reviewed that information and said primarily the Bishop and Barth cases that were before the district court, and said, your allegation is that the tax court will not entertain federal constitutional challenges. I don't see anything in the opinion that you raised federal constitutional challenges or that federal constitutional challenges were raised in those cases.
But the court relied on the Indiana tax courts and the fact that they do hear as-applied challenges. And of course, that's in published opinions. Are you saying the court can't take judicial notice of those?
What the taxpayers are prepared to do is bring forth records of those cases that show that statement is an illusory offer, and that there is no right to raise those federal issues. And the court, because we never had an evidentiary hearing or oral arguments on this, the taxpayers never had an opportunity to point to other language very specifically within the Indiana Supreme Court and the Indiana Tax Court decisions, which say even if you raise federal constitutional issues with merit, we're not going to analyze them. That denies a taxpayer a full hearing and determination, which would allow us to appeal an issue and take it up through the chain. That is the core of what we have in these cases.
Why can't the plaintiffs get all the appropriate relief they seek through an as-applied challenge in the tax court?
The tax court very specifically stated there is no such thing as an as-applied constitutional challenge under Indiana's system. And again, it relies on specific language of the tax court decision, but because Indiana has divorced its assessment system from market value, you've got a closed, self-referential set of regulations which determine what an assessment is. Individual measures of property wealth are not accepted in reviewing the application of those regulations. So the tax court, in specific language in the Town of St. John cases, says that there is no such thing as an as-applied challenge. Now, the tax court says that. I disagree. When you have an individual appeal that goes through the system and you challenge the constitutionality as applied to that individual taxpayer, I would argue that that is an as-applied challenge, even though it's a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the regulations as applied to that taxpayer. And this all goes back. This court reviewed in the late 1970s Indiana's procedure and said, Indiana provides a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy. The district court and the state's brief indicate that there have only been minor changes since that time. We certainly disagree with that. In 1988, that's the date when Indiana divorced itself from market value. So assessment became a subject purely of regulation and not with reference to market value. Litigation results from the resulting system of that closed system ended up in the Town of St. John line of cases, where the Indiana courts found that that closed system denies taxpayers a meaningful opportunity for review and is arbitrary and capricious. I see that I've gotten into my rebuttal time.
Thank you. Mr. Arthur.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is David Arthur. I'm a Deputy Attorney General of Indiana here on behalf of the appellees. Starting with the end of the taxpayer's argument, they're wrong. The Indiana Tax Court will accept as-applied challenges. In Dana Corporation versus State Board of Tax Commissioners, which was not cited to this court but was cited to the district court in the memorandum in support of the motion to dismiss, reported at 694 Northeast 2nd, 1244. The court said, in other words, this is the Indiana Tax Court speaking, In other words, this court will not entertain facial challenges to a property tax assessment. It will, however, hear as-applied challenges just as it always has done. So clearly, the taxpayers in this case could bring as-applied challenges, including on federal bases, before the Indiana Tax Court. For that reason, the decision of the district court that there is a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy in the Indiana court such that the Tax Injunction Act precludes jurisdiction in this case is correct.
Do you have any authority, by the way, for the proposition the contention that that Indiana provides no plain, speedy, and efficient remedy is a conclusion of law and not fact? In other words, are there any cases where similar contentions were deemed to be questions of law and not fact?
None that I have found, but what we're dealing with is the application of a statute, the meaning of a statute that has been construed many, many times by courts, and they are approached as issues of law, the question of whether there is a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy. For example, this court in Miller versus Bauer back in 1975, which is one of the cases that no relation that I know of, Your Honor.
Well, the word means peasant in German, so there's millions of them.
I wasn't aware of that and prefer not to comment any further. In that case, this court addressed it on the face The case was dismissed by Judge Sharp, who was then sitting in the Hammond Division. This court affirmed, and it was looking at the face rather than at any kind of factual determination. So judging from that, judging by the other cases, the approaches that they've taken, it would be a question of law. But in specific reference to the court's question of do I have a case I can cite, the answer is no.
Okay.
And the only case that the plaintiff was able to come up, the taxpayers were able to come up with, was a district court decision from another circuit in 1974. So it's not a question that has been litigated to any extent across the country. The cases on which the taxpayers rely for their contention that the tax court should not have gone beyond the four corners of the complaint, should have accepted the jurisdictional allegation.
You mean the district court should have?
I'm sorry.
Did you mean the district court should have on the jurisdictional question? You start all over again with what you were going to say.
What the taxpayers, the basis for their claim that the district court should not have looked beyond, did I say the wrong court?
Yeah,
before
you said
when
the
I
wrong
that?
Court.
I'm sorry. That the district court should not have gone beyond the four corners of the complaint, should have accepted the allegations of jurisdiction as true, as binding, is based upon cases that say that when there is a factual challenge that's raised, then the district courts may go beyond the four corners, but none of those cases says that that is the only situation in which the tax court can look beyond the four corners of the complaint.
District court.
I keep saying tax court, don't I?
Yes.
That's the problem with working in two different systems. I confuse myself sometimes as to where I'm at.
That's all right. I thought we were in Indiana when we were in Illinois a little while ago.
There is nothing that precludes the United States District Court from going beyond the face of the complaint and requires it to accept the jurisdictional allegations that are made by the plaintiffs when there is a proper motion to dismiss that is filed, when an answer is filed that controverts the facts or even just denies the jurisdiction, as some of the cases cited in our brief discuss. And in fact, as this court has brought up, it's incumbent upon, not only is it allowed, but incumbent upon the federal courts to inquire into their jurisdiction through any
means. This court is famous for it.
Yes, it is. I've seen many orders that have come out, and you've requested documentation beyond what is in the record in habeas cases, for example, which I've handled a few of. There have been questions about whether the issue is moot. In light of the release of the apparent release of the offender, the court has asked for further documentation. It shows that this court and other federal courts take both the Article III restrictions on jurisdiction and statutory restrictions such as the Tax Injunction Act very seriously and do go beyond the record to inquire as to whether or not jurisdiction is present. We believe this is a very simple issue, that there's not a lot to address. It is addressed in our brief, and unless there are any questions from the court, I have nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Arthur. Mr. Pippin, how much time?
The case law is very clear that the general rule is that well-pled facts will be accepted as, and their reasonable inferences will be accepted as true. If that's the general rule, there has to be something that triggers an exception to that rule. Our position is that the trigger is that there is something that brings question upon some of the factual allegations. That trigger can be a proffer of evidence. As the state indicates, there's some case law that's out there that says an answer that questions some of the facts might be the way to do it. In any event, there has to be some question brought to the factual allegations before they're removed from the general rule, which is that they're accepted as true. And then once you've gone beyond that, once a question has been raised, then there's another consideration in there, and that consideration is, what do we do next? And this court has said very clearly that if those kinds of challenges have been made, the plaintiff has to be given an opportunity to confront the challenge to the facts. They have to be given an opportunity to develop the record so that the court knows, so that there is an evidentiary basis upon which a decision can be based. The state refers to a Dana Corporation decision and says, well, the tax court says it will entertain this. That's a factual determination. If the tax court says it will do this, but then doesn't in fact do it, that's a factual determination. If the record reveals that federal complaints have been raised and not given a full hearing and determination, that's a factual determination that needs to be developed for the record. And so that's a question, in my mind, that says, of course, the district court acted too swiftly in this case without allowing the record to be developed. The other position that the state takes with respect to the tax injunction statute is that the plain, speedy, and efficient determination is a matter of law, and that because this court ruled in the late 1970s that Indiana provides a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy, that it's easy and we can just throw it out. Well, there's a real problem with that position, because the logical absurdity of that is a state could have set up a straw set of procedures, never obey them, but because the procedures are there and they say you have this right, you can never challenge or protect your federal constitutional rights in federal court. It's a factual question whether those procedures are followed. It's a factual question that must be developed so that the record is full, so that the court knows what is going on and can act accordingly if the taxpayer's federal constitutional rights are not protected. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both of you, Mr. Pippin and Mr. Arthur. The two Davids. Thank you. The case will be taken under